Today, I'm going to be talking about scaling applications, and really my goal for the talk is just to get you thinking about, are there things that I could do or decisions I could make now, either architecturally or as far as infrastructure goes, that will make my job easier when whatever the app is or the services that I'm building, if you're a startup right now, when it hits the big time like everybody assumes they're going to someday, or when you really need scalability or availability, are there decisions you can make now to kind of help you out down the road in the future? So first of all, just a little bit about me, because you're probably wondering who I am. I'm a language evangelist. It's a made-up title. So the language part of my title basically just means that I have a focus on a particular programming community. In my case, it's the .NET community. That's because prior to living the glamorous life of an evangelist, I was a developer for the last 15 years. So the last 10 or so, primarily in the .NET stack in the Microsoft world. But before that, Java, PHP, even these days, a little bit of Node.js and some of the new hotness like that too. So mostly with relational database, mostly building like web apps, that kind of stuff. I also got a chance to recently present at the Cassandra Summit in San Francisco. This was back in September of last year. And I got to co-present with Microsoft, so I got to co-present with an Azure evangelist, which was pretty cool. And I tell you that so that I can show you this picture of what I think most people at the Cassandra Summit, it's a big open source conference, what they thought about Microsoft being a presenter at a big open source conference like that. Historically, Microsoft has not had the greatest reputation when it comes to open source software and open source communities and whatnot, but it's been awesome, like just since September of last year, just in the last 6 months, like some of the stuff coming out of, just to show you the same slide that Tim showed you earlier, it's been awesome to see some of the announcements coming out of there. So, being a .NET guy, I was really excited that they finally open sourced the .NET framework. Another good example would be them contributing to Docker to add Windows support for Windows containers in Docker, another great thing. So it's kind of a really cool thing to see them kind of turn the corner and really start to embrace open source and whatnot. So this is kind of the agenda for the talk. We'll talk about the problems, kind of the state of things, like building applications on top of relational databases. What are some things we do to kind of scale and get high availability? Then we're going to talk a little bit about Cassandra, and kind of I'll try to give you a little bit of an introduction. But who here tomorrow? Who is not going to Cassandra Day tomorrow? Is it like everybody know we have an event tomorrow? Anybody not going to Cassandra Day tomorrow? So we have an event tomorrow that's a whole day of free training. I'll be speaking along with some other people that are here with DataStax. And if you're interested in going, you can hit me up after the talk, or I don't know if there's any other. I don't see Patrick. There's a couple people in the back too. You can hit us up for information about if you want to attend Cassandra Day tomorrow. So I don't want to give away too much Cassandra information because we've got like a whole day of it tomorrow, and I don't want people to hear a bunch of repeated stuff tomorrow. Then we're going to talk about an actual application that I built. It's built on Cassandra and Azure, and we'll kind of talk about some of the architecture and architectural decisions and whatnot. Just give you some food for thought, like for your own apps. Then we'll talk about a kind of a cool feature of Azure that doesn't really have an analog in other clouds. So I'm going to talk about Azure Media Services. So if you're doing anything with like streaming video or video encoding or something like that, you might find that interesting. There's not really an analog in GCE or AWS, which is kind of cool. And then lastly, we'll talk about Cassandra and Azure together. Like, how do you run Cassandra on Azure? What are some recommendations? I'll show you a little bit of Ops Center. So I'm going to show a few demos kind of throughout, and hopefully, live demos, they usually crash and burn, but we'll see. All right, so why are we even talking about this? So here I got typical sort of application, like web application that you might build. You've got a web server, you got an app server, maybe running some background tasks, that kind of thing, talking to some sort of relational database on the back end. And when we're building stuff like this as developers, we all want, we're kind of in the back of our heads thinking, okay, we want availability. Everybody wants to be 100% uptime, right? Or six nines or however many nines it is. And we also want to be scalable, right? So when this thing that we're building like is super successful, we want to be able to easily kind of scale it out. And when we talk about that app tier there, we talk about website, web servers and app servers. That's usually pretty easy to do. Usually the app tier is stateless because we're storing state back in our relational database. And so it's pretty easy to spin up more instances, especially when we're talking about cloud infrastructure where it's really easy to spin up new VMs. Pretty simple to do that. But the problem is that on the back end there, we're still talking to that single relational database. And so we try to do, we're still talking to this single relational database, there's some tricks that we tend to try to do when our relational database kind of becomes the bottleneck in our application and we need to think about scaling it up, or we're thinking about high availability, how do we make this thing available in the case of machine failures and whatnot. So let's talk about some of those things. So the first thing we do usually is we scale up first. So faster hardware, a bigger SAN, more memory, a faster processor. And the problem with this is that as we scale up this direction, after we get off commodity hardware and we start to get to this more specialized hardware, it gets really expensive really quickly. And this always reminds me of my favorite Oracle exception of all time. At my last job, we were like the unholy combination of software vendors where we were .NET and Oracle together, which is like, I don't know, just strange. But I thought this was funny that this was actually an Oracle exception. And this isn't what happens when you forget to pay your support contract to Oracle. It actually has something to do with something totally different. So another thing that we'll do when we start having problems with queries that won't perform. So I've got a query like this one on the right. Anybody use ORMs? Like, you ever seen an ORM generate a query like this? I've seen ORMs generate queries like this, but you've got all these joins. And the problem with joins is they don't scale once we get enough of them kind of going. And so what we'll do is we'll, instead of doing all these joins for our poorly performing queries, we'll create tables and we'll denormalize our data so at write time, we write data into these tables that are built just to answer these queries, right? So at this point, we've kind of gotten rid of our third normal form, which is sort of anybody who's done any work on a relational database kind of knows third normal form. It's sort of the way that you data model. You don't duplicate, you avoid duplication. It's been drilled into us for many years. And if you do something like, I don't know if anybody's ever seen materialized views in Oracle, that's a feature that Oracle has, for example, where they will actually take a query like this and materialize it into a table for you. You actually tell it to refresh that on an interval. So you say, refresh this every minute or refresh this every hour or something like that. And so at that point, if we do a feature like that, we've also introduced eventual consistency into our views, into our view model. So that's another, we've kind of gotten rid of one of the ACID properties that kind of makes building on a relational database kind of a nice thing. So another thing that we'll do as far as scaling reads go is replication. And we do this sometimes for scaling reads, but then also sometimes for high availability as well. So sometimes it's called master-slave replication. Sometimes you may have heard read replication before. But the basic idea is I send all of my writes to a primary, and then I chain some secondary servers behind it, and any write that gets written to the primary then gets replicated to the secondary servers. And you can set up more than one sort of secondary server. And so sometimes what you'll do to scale reads is you'll send all your write requests to that primary, and then you'll send all your read requests to those replicas. Now, you're not going to beat the laws of physics. There's going to be a lag between the time that you write data to your master and the time that it gets to those slaves, those read replicas. So at this point, if you're doing that for read replication, you've introduced eventual consistency in your system. So you've kind of gotten rid of some of the ACID guarantees that are kind of nice to have when you're building on a relational database. And if you're doing this for high availability, a lot of times you'll have failover involved. So this might be a manual process where somebody actually has to push a button. This could be an automatic process where something's sort of monitoring to kind of keep, kind of see if the server goes down and then fail over to a backup, that kind of thing. And so you start introducing these other parts into the system. And if it's an automated system, then you got to have something that watches the automated system to make sure that it stays up so that it can fail over. And usually there's a period of failure too where you're actually down, where your database is actually down, and you have downtime before you're able to fail over to some sort of slave behind the scenes. Now, this is all fine and good for scaling out reads, but if you want to scale out writes, you still got that single sort of primary server as your bottleneck for writes. So when you go to try and scale out writes on a relational database, a lot of times what you'll do is sharding. So this is an example of user data sharded by name, which is an example of a terrible shard key. So you can imagine like A through F, your shard would probably be way bigger than your U through Z shard, for example. So picking the right shard key is important. But this also pushes a lot of complexity back to you as a developer. So I've got this router component here, and I've actually seen this be, there are some vendors that actually sell appliances that will do this, like sit in front of your MySQL and do the routing for you. So when you do a write, you need to have something that knows which shard to go talk to based on the shard key. And so sometimes this is in code, and sometimes this is actually an appliance. But the thing about doing sharding like this is that you're also giving up some of these things that you were, you know, like when you built your application on a relational database, like being able to do joins or aggregations or subselects. If you have to do that across shards or transactions even, if you have to do that across shards, you're going to be writing a lot more complicated code, and sometimes you're just out of luck. And the other thing is, now you've got all these servers, so now you've got to, when you propagate schema changes, so I need to do a schema migration or something like that, now I've got to keep this in sync across all of these multiple servers, essentially. So you got sharding, you got replication, you're denormalizing, you're doing all of these things to kind of try and scale out your relational database. And sometimes you do like a combination of all of them. And so you see, like, now I've got all these moving parts, you know, like who's watching what, like what's watching the failover process. And like, you know, at some point you like start to think that maybe you built like the self-operating napkin sort of thing. Like you've made this super complex. And at the end of the day, like a lot of the stuff like third normal form that you're used to, that kind of went out the window when you denormalized, and your ACID constraints, you know, consistency and that kind of stuff. Well, that doesn't hold anymore because you sharded, and now you can't do stuff across shards and things like that. So a lot of these things that you kind of built your, you know, system on, these assumptions that you built your system on to begin with, aren't there anymore, and you've kind of turned your relational database into this super expensive disk babysitter on some level. And so at this point, you know, people, there have been, and I'm not going to tell you that you can't do this. So you can, absolutely. Like Facebook, for example, they do this. Like they have scaled out MySQL and have made that work for Facebook. And that's probably the busiest, if not the busiest, definitely one of the busiest sites on the planet. But when we started running into these problems with scaling out relational databases, this is kind of where the NoSQL movement came from. And so I really liked this this picture of sort of the history of NoSQL, and in particular the last one in 2013, No, We Have SQL. It's totally true. If you start looking at us, like I'm going to show you some CQL, which is very similar to SQL, CQL being the query language for Cassandra. And you're seeing more and more vendors like kind of be like, no, look, we have a SQL-like query language on top of our NoSQL database. So it's kind of moving in that direction, which is interesting. So why might you think about using something other than a relational database? So if you've got volume, so if you've got a lot of data, like more data than might fit on a single machine, if you've got velocity problems, so you've got more transactions than can be handled, more read or write volume, essentially, than can be handled by a single machine. You need availability, so you don't want that single point of failure, that single database, or you don't want that downtime, you know, that you have to have when you fail over to, you know, from a master to a slave. You need to always be available for reading and writing. Geographic complexity, so you need your data in multiple data centers. So I was talking to Greg earlier, who was up here from the startup, and he was talking about doing Oracle in multiple data centers, and I was like, I didn't even know you could do that. Like, I didn't think that was possible. But if you need multiple data centers where, if that's either for availability or it's because you want to get your data closer to your customers, so you know you want your customers in Europe to actually have a data center there with the data in it, that kind of thing. And then structure. So if you've got data that isn't best represented as a relational database, like we've been trying to stuff all kinds of things into relational databases for like 20 years now, and sometimes you have a problem that looks like a graph. And if you have a problem that looks like a graph, it turns out these days there are databases that are for graphs. So, you know, use the right, this idea of polyglot persistence, you know, use the right tool for the problem that you have, basically. So, in the mid-2000s, when people started looking at this problem, you know, you had these really big web scale kind of sites, to use a buzzword. You had some papers that came out that were kind of important. So in 2007, Amazon, they put out the Dynamo paper. I don't know, has anybody ever read the Dynamo paper? Yeah? Well, I know Patrick has. Yeah. But so Dynamo paper is actually really, like, so I'm really bad at reading papers like this. Like, it's like a skill I never absorbed when I went to college or something like that. I feel like it's an acquired skill. But the Dynamo paper is actually pretty approachable. So if you haven't read it, like, I absolutely encourage you to read it. So basically the question they were asking is, how do we build a data store that is always on, that's performant, that's reliable, to power stuff like Amazon's shopping cart, for example? And so they cited a bunch of papers going all the way back to the 70s. This wasn't like revolutionary computer science. This was built on like stuff that had been, you know, research that had been done for many, many years, and they went back and they looked at it and they said, how can we apply this research to today's problems? So they had 24 papers cited, and it was certainly a case of everything that's old is sort of new again. In 2006, then, we had the Google Bigtable paper. So so this richer data model, one key with lots of values, like different data types, that kind of stuff, fast sequential access to data. And again, this was a case of like not revolutionary computer science. They cited a lot of old papers that had been that had been done many, many years ago, but not revolutionary so much as evolutionary computer science. And then in 2008, we got Cassandra. So this was from Facebook. So this was a mashing together of the distributed features from Dynamo, so stuff like gossip and that kind of stuff, along with the data model, the sort of richer data model and storage model from Bigtable. And they kind of mashed them together and put it into a product called Cassandra. And they open sourced it in 2008. And then in 2010, it became a top-level Apache project. So it's if you go to Apache's website, it's now a top-level Apache project. So it came out in 2008 after, I guess, a little over 6 years now. How are we doing? So number 8 in the DB Engines rankings. So it's growing. It's climbing in popularity. I don't know why Microsoft Access is sitting in the number 7 position there. Like, I was like, wow, Access is way popular. Like, I can't believe that. But hopefully we'll overtake Access at some point. But it's growing, and the more that developers tend to find out like some of the things that it's good for and whatnot, the more people tend to get excited about it. So before you get too excited about it, let's talk about what it is not. So Cassandra is not a data ocean, a data lake, or a data pond. So if you're building like a data warehouse of some kind, or you like these buzzwords, this is not what Cassandra is for. It's not an in-memory database. So if you need an in-memory database, there's a bunch to pick from, like Redis comes to mind, or Memcache is if you need a cache sort of thing. It's not an in-memory database. Now, DataStax Enterprise actually does have an in-memory option that I'm not gonna talk about, but it does have an in-memory option if you like Cassandra's data model. But Cassandra itself, core Cassandra, is not an in-memory database. It's not a key value store. So again, it's not a cache. If you need a cache, use a cache. And it's not a magical database unicorn that will solve all of your problems and solve every database use case that you have. There are different databases because there are different use cases. So it's not going to solve all of your problems. So when should you think about using like an Oracle or a SQL Server or a Postgres or insert your relational database here? So if you've got a loose data model with joins and subselects, ad hoc querying, that kind of stuff, you might think about sticking with a relational database. If you need absolute consistency, so you absolutely need those ACID requirements, and most of us developers, we take this for granted, so I know I certainly did building applications on relational databases for a while. But if you've never thought about it, maybe it makes sense to kind of think, what do I really need? But if you absolutely need that consistency at the expense of keeping it on a single server or all that complexity that comes with trying to replicate relational databases, then stick with relational database. If you have no need to use anything else, so don't switch just for the sake of switching, basically. Like I said, we definitely live in an era of polyglot persistence. So if you have some other kind of problem that's better served by a different database, like I said, Cassandra is not a database unicorn. It's not going to solve all of your problems. So don't switch just for the sake of switching. And if you'll miss the long candlelit dinners with your Oracle rep that always end with, what's your budget look like this year? then stick with Cassandra as well, or stick with relational database as well. So when might you think about using Cassandra? So if uptime is a top priority, so availability, you always want to be available for reading and writing, that kind of thing. You have unpredictable or high scaling requirements. So your load looks like this, or you got the hockey stick problem, or your load looks like that. Scaling problems like that, definitely a use case for Cassandra. If your workload is transactional, so like I mentioned earlier, Cassandra is not a data warehouse. It's not really for the analytical side of things. Now, there are some tools that you can integrate with Cassandra that you can put on top of Cassandra, like Spark and Solr, that will do more of the analytics workloads on top of your Cassandra data. But Cassandra, core Cassandra itself, is a transactional database. It's not for analytics. And if you're willing to put the time and effort into learning about how it works. So people see SQL for the first time, and it looks very much like SQL, and they think, oh man, I can just pick up like my data model, like my tables, and I can pick up my queries and move them, and everything, like I just have to change a few things. It's like just a little bit different syntax and everything will just work. And then plus I get all this like extra great stuff like high availability, and that's basically a recipe for failure. So if you do that and then you come back to me like 2 months later and you're like, Cassandra sucks, why did you tell me to use it? I'm gonna tell you to go read the manual and spend some time, you know, getting to learn how to do it. So especially when it comes to data modeling in particular, data modeling is very different in Cassandra than it is in the relational world that you're used to. So let's talk about like what is Cassandra, actually. All right, so Cassandra is a fully distributed, a linear scaling and fault tolerant fully distributed database. So that's a freaking mouthful. So I kind of want to break each part of that down individually and kind of talk about each part. So first we'll talk about distributed. So data in your cluster is spread across many nodes. And by nodes, we basically mean machines, so virtual machines. All nodes are equal. All nodes participate in this cluster. So there's no like master-slave relationship. There's no, everything is equal and there's only one node type. So it's a shared nothing architecture, very much a peer-to-peer type architecture. It's linearly scaling. So this basically means if you have more data, you just add more nodes to your cluster. It also means if you need more throughput, so you need to handle more reads or writes, more transactions, you can also just add more nodes to your cluster. So I put this graph up here, and this is from some tests that Netflix did, where they were testing sort of scale-up linearity of write throughput as they added more nodes. So you can see, as they doubled the number of nodes in their cluster, they basically doubled their throughput. So it's kind of cool. It's very predictable scaling. Not a lot of distributed systems can say they scale like this in a linear fashion. It's also fault tolerance. So this means that nodes can go down, and we all know machines fail, especially in cloud environment, and your database isn't down. It also means you can lose an entire data center. So if you're at a multiple data center setup, which is absolutely possible, it's one of the things that was kind of baked in to Cassandra from the beginning, you can lose an entire data center and not go down. So I put this tweet up here. It's from Nathan Milford. He used to work for Outbrain. And they actually lost a data center to Hurricane Sandy a few years ago. And he was talking about basically just once they were able to get back in that data center, spin the machines back up, just how easy it was to have the data stream in from their other data centers and be back up and running in that data center relatively quickly, which is pretty cool. So I mentioned multi-DC. So fully replicated, your clients tend to write to the local data center that they're in, and then data gets replicated via the WAN to your other data centers. You can have as many data centers as you want. You can run them in multiple clouds, so you could have one in Azure and one in Amazon and one in GCE. You could put one on the moon if you wanted to. Latency would be terrible, but you could. So you can also configure a replication factor per data center. So replication factor basically just means how many copies of your data are there. So you know, I might have 3 copies in my US East and 4 copies in my US West and 5 in Europe and so on and so forth. That can be configured independent. So we can't talk about a distributed system without at least mentioning the CAP theorem. So this is like my obligatory CAP theorem slide. So CAP, everybody probably has heard it at some point at this point. So CAP stands for consistency, availability, and partition tolerance. And the CAP theorem basically just limits what a distributed system can do. So it says, in a distributed system, you can't have all 3 of those. You can only have 2 out of those 3. And most people will tell you that you have to pick partition tolerance because in the real world, network partitions happen. You have times where machines can't talk to each other. Machines in your cluster can't talk to each other. So really, you're left with picking either consistency or availability. And so Cassandra is an AP system. It shows an availability over consistency that is eventually consistent. And so we'll talk in a few slides here, this idea of being able to trade consistency for availability and how Cassandra kind of lets you pick and choose which parts of your system you want to have stronger consistency at the expense of availability and then vice versa. So there's 2 knobs in Cassandra that kind of control fault tolerance, this idea of it being fault tolerant. So one is configured on the server side, and then the other is configured on the client side. So on the server side, you have something called replication factor. You'll do this when you set up your cluster for the first time, or actually when you create your key space, like I just created in the demo. So this basically just means, like I said before, how many copies of your data do you want? So in this example here, a client writes A. You can see the A server gets a copy, the B server gets a copy, and the C server gets a copy for a total of 3 copies for a replication factor of 3. The other one is consistency level. So this is set on the client side. So every time that you do a read or a write against your cluster, you'll get to set the consistency level in your code. And so this basically just means how many replicas do I need to hear from before I can acknowledge to the client, like, hey, your operation was successful. So for a write, how many replicas do we need to hear from before we say, hey, yeah, we got your data? Or for a read, how many replicas do we need to get an answer from before we give you back the data that you asked for? And so I'm going to show you an example of two of the most popular ones. So first one is consistency level of one, which, like the name sort of implies, means one replica. So you can see example, client writes A, the A server gets it and says, okay, yeah, we got your data. Now, I put those dashed lines there to sort of indicate that just because we write at a consistency level of one doesn't mean that we don't still honor your replication factor. So your replication factor, the data will still get replicated to those other two servers. The other one that's really popular that people use a lot is quorum. So if you've never heard the term quorum before, quorum basically just means a majority of replicas. So if I have a replication factor of three, a quorum would be two out of those three servers. So you can see, same example, client writes A server gets a copy, then you have the B server gets a copy, it responds back and says, yep, got it. And then at that point, we can respond to the client and say, hey, yeah, we've got your data. And so again, dashed line indicates we still replicate according to the replication factor, so that other node is still going to get a copy as well. So this is a list, a more complete list of some of the other consistency levels that are available to you. So this isn't a totally complete list. There's really two things I want to point out on this. So local one and local quorum. So if you're in a multi-data center setup, which is definitely popular with Cassandra, you'll probably use local one and local quorum because those are mean just wait on nodes in my own replicas in my own data center. And then all, I point that out because we like to refer to it sometimes as the super paranoid consistency level. So don't use this, even though it's there. Like the name implies, it does mean all replicas. And I'll kind of explain in the next few slides when we talk about why you might pick one, like why would you pick one consistency level versus another, kind of point out what would happen if you were to pick all in some of these scenarios. So remember, you get to apply this to at each read or each write in like that you do. So any given query, any given part of your system, you can kind of pick what consistency level you want to use. So Cassandra won't impose like one across your entire app. You kind of get to pick and choose based on different parts of your application. So first let's talk about how it affects speed, why you might choose a consistency level and speed. So how many replicas you need to hear from is going to affect how quickly you can read and write data from to your cluster. So here's that example where we got reading a value A at consistency level of quorum, and you can see two nodes respond pretty quickly, so we get a 5 microsecond ACK, we get a 12 microsecond ACK, and then for some reason one node is like really slow, maybe it's having a garbage collection or something like that, 300 microsecond ACK, takes forever. And you can see we were able to return to the client in 12 microseconds, and this is because we read at quorum, so we only needed to hear from two out of the three replicas before we could respond. Now you imagine, if we had done this at one, we would have been even faster. We would have been like a 5 microsecond ACK. We would have been able to respond after the first one. But if we had done this at all, the super paranoid consistency level, then we would have been waiting on that really slow server that really slow replica to respond. And so we would have been a lot slower responding to our client. So if you use a higher consistency level, you're probably going to get slower operations against your cluster. Versus if you use a lower one, you probably get much faster operations against your cluster. This will also affect your availability. So here's an example of reading A again at quorum, and one of the nodes that we would normally hear from is down this time. So it's had a failure, like a hard drive crashed, or the VM went down, or whatever, you know, servers fail. And even though a server was down, because we read at quorum, we only needed to hear from two out of three replicas, we were still able to respond to the client with an answer. Now you can imagine if we had done this at one, we also would have been cool, like we would have been able to send a response back because we would have heard from one of those two that were still remaining. But if we had done this at all at the super paranoid consistency level, we would have had to respond with a failure because one of the replicas we needed to hear from was down. So if you use a really high consistency level, you're going to have lower availability. So this is that cap trade-off, consistency for availability. And if you use a lower consistency level, you're going to have much higher availability. You're going to be able to tolerate more failures, basically. So the last thing I wanted to mention about Cassandra really is this idea of eventual consistency. So we said Cassandra is an AP system that is eventually consistent. And so from time to time, you may get replicas that disagree. So all replicas may not have heard the latest update. They may not know sort of the latest value for a given key. And so what happens in Cassandra is all column values, when you write them, they get a timestamp. And in Cassandra, when you have these replicas that disagree, like in this example here, last write wins, it uses last write wins semantics. Whatever has the latest timestamp is the one that's going to actually get returned to the client. So you can see a read at quorum here. One node says A equals 2 with a newer timestamp. One says A equals 1 with an older timestamp. And we actually send back A equals 2 because it had the newer timestamp. Now, you can imagine if we had done this read at 1 instead of quorum, if we had just heard from one replica, it's possible that the first replica to respond in this case might have been the one with the older data. So we might have actually returned stale data to our client. So if you use what consistency level you choose will affect whether or not you can read stale data essentially from your cluster. So you may be in some scenarios in your application that may be totally fine, may not be a big deal. There may be other places where you need to always have the latest value, and so you need to use a higher consistency level. And the other thing I want to mention, I put this link, so this will be on my slideshare later if you want to check it out. But I put a link to Christos's webinar called Eventual Consistency Does Not Equal Hopeful Consistency. So if you're like me and you've done programming on relational databases for a while, this idea of eventual consistency can be kind of scary at first. And you might be thinking like, well, what the heck does eventual mean? Like, are we talking like minutes, hours, days, weeks? Like, how long is it going to take data to actually get replicated? And Christos talks about, so he works for Netflix and talks about some experiments they did inside of Netflix to find out, well, just how eventual is eventual. And it turns out, like most of the time, like with a normally functioning network, you're talking on the order of milliseconds. And in cross data center, even in a multi-data center setup, which they tested, it was tens of milliseconds or hundreds of milliseconds, depending on basically the latency of how long the connection was. So east coast to west coast, I think they were talking tens of milliseconds. If you were going west coast to Europe, it might be more latency, obviously. But definitely check that out. If the idea of eventual consistency scares you, it's a really great talk. It's like a half an hour video. Really good. So live demo available. You saw it at killervideo.com. It's written in C# and JavaScript. It's running in Azure. It's backed by a DataStax Enterprise cluster. It's open source under Apache 2 license. So if you're interested in the code, even if you're not a C# developer and you just want to see like a schema, you know, like what does a CQL schema look like and how does it kind of compare to like an SQL schema, you check that out. It's an interesting use case, like I said, because data modeling, like it's going to be familiar to developers. They're like, yeah, I know what YouTube is. Like, you know, I know kind of like how I might do that in a relational database and then how you might do it in Cassandra. And it's also interesting because of the scale of something like YouTube. So if you think, I put a couple statistics up here from YouTube, like they get more than a billion unique users each month. They get over 100 hours of video uploaded to YouTube every minute. So if you were really building something like this to compete with a YouTube, like you can imagine the sheer number of servers, multiple data centers probably for availability. Like it's an interesting use case from that perspective as well. So this is kind of what the architecture looks like. So you can see up top, we got a web UI. We've got an MVC app. Kind of this is serving up the web UI and also doing like JSON REST type JSON endpoints to answer AJAX calls from the web UI. Then you got a tier of services underneath, and I put like four of them up here, but there's really eight or nine actually kind of going on. So video catalog, tracking catalog of videos, obviously, you know, comment service for tracking comments. It's really organized by sort of business capability, like what functionality does it provide to the site. And then underneath, we got an infrastructure tier. So we got Ops Center, which I'm going to show you a demo of. We've got Cassandra Cluster, DSE, Azure Service Bus, which is sort of like PubSub messaging. If you're used to that, you know, most cloud providers have it. We've got Azure Storage, like Blob and Queue storage. And then we've got Azure Media Services, which I'm going to talk about in depth here in a sec. So what's a service? Simple service, you got video catalog. So this is probably one of the simplest services on the site. And so it's using Cassandra to store metadata about videos, stuff like the name and description and title, that kind of stuff. Then it's also using Azure Service Bus to kind of publish interesting events, interesting things that happen inside of it. So like, hey, I just added some new YouTube video to the catalog, or hey, I just accepted a new uploaded video, that kind of thing. And then this is a more complicated service. So uploads is an example of probably the most complicated service on the site. And so it's responsible for processing uploads, like videos that users send to us, and re-encoding them into something that can actually be played back in the app, because we don't know sort of what format they're going to throw at us. We need to turn it into something that we can actually play back in our application. So Cassandra Cluster, again, it's going to store data about the uploaded video. It's going to store the job status of those jobs that are doing the re-encoding and that kind of thing. We've got Azure Storage, where we're actually storing the video files themselves, as well as the re-encoded videos, that kind of thing. And Azure Media Services, which is actually doing the heavy lifting of the re-encoding of videos and creating thumbnail previews, that kind of thing. And then again, Azure Service Bus, where we're actually publishing sort of interesting events that happen inside of the system. So uploaded video has been published, that kind of thing, like gets ready for playback, that sort of thing. So the thing about an architecture like this, it's really normally referred to as sort of like an event-driven architecture, if you've ever heard the term before. Only the application is actually sending commands to these services. The services never actually call each other directly where they're sending each other commands directly. They're all decoupled and using pub-sub messaging where they're very much event-driven. So one service says, hey, this happened, and then another service is subscribing to that event, and it says, oh, I better do something in reaction to that event. And so the nice thing about an architecture like this is that all of the services are decoupled from each other, and the services could be deployed independent of each other. They could be scaled up independent of each other. They could be versioned. I could have different teams working on them and versioning them at their own sort of pace, being developed at their own sort of pace. And so if that sounds familiar, this is sort of the idea behind microservices. So anybody heard the term microservices before? Like, good Lord, that's like the... Yeah, it's like the new buzzword in software architecture these days. But this is basically the idea behind microservices. So some people will tell you like you should use HTTP and REST to do this. That's totally a way that you could accomplish that architecture. I'm a big fan of async messaging and PubSub messaging. So yeah, c'est la vie, six half dozen sort of thing. Another nice thing about this architecture is that I get to make technology decisions at a much more granular level. So if I have inside of one service, like my suggested video service, it might look more like a graph problem where I need to use a graph database. I might have another service where it makes more sense to continue using a relational database. But I get to make these decisions about what infrastructure to use, and I also get to make the decisions even about like programming languages, for example. So I could mix and match. I could do Python for one service. I could do C# in another service. And you kind of get this extra flexibility. Now you get that with the expense of now you can't run services together in process anymore, which you know, maybe a big deal in your scenario, but the added flexibility may be absolutely worth it. So here's an example of what I mean by sort of like services interacting via events. So you got the video catalog and it says, hey, I just added this new YouTube video, like a user just added this new YouTube video to the catalog. And then you might have two other services subscribing to those events. And so, for example, suggested videos might say, ooh, I need to figure out what videos to suggest for that new YouTube video that just got added. Or a search service might say, ooh, I need to index that new video so it starts showing up in search results. So very decoupled, services kind of reacting to each other via PubSub messaging. So I mentioned being able to build stuff in different languages on different platforms being like one of the benefits of an architecture like this. And I was gonna originally do this as two different slides, but when I had the two different slides, they were so identical that it just made sense to put them all together on a single slide. So this is some things that you actually saw in some of Tim's slides about the platforms and the languages that you can do both Cassandra and Azure with. So first thing to know is that all of the Azure SDKs and all of the DataStax drivers for Cassandra are all open source. They're on an Apache 2 license. So it's funny, they even use the same license, the same open source license, the Azure and the Cassandra drivers. And they're all on GitHub. So you can see links to GitHub where you can actually go get the source, that kind of stuff. Tim talked about languages earlier, so Azure definitely is not just for .NET. You can do all kinds of languages with DataStax drivers as well. So you can see the overlap in that blue bar. One thing to mention is DataStax also has a C++ driver, so if you're actually doing C++ code, there's a Cassandra driver for C++ as well. And then you can also run on either Windows or Linux. So Cassandra is a JVM application, and ideally you'd deploy it on Linux, especially if you're using less than version 2.1. If you're using 2.1 or greater and you want to deploy on Windows in production, it's sort of in beta support right now. We're hoping that performance parity will be, like the performance problems in Windows will be sort of ironed out and gone by 3.0. So 3.0 hopefully is coming in the next few months for Cassandra. And at that point, you should be able to run production deployments on kind of whichever platform you want. And I don't think Tim mentioned the stat, but a lot of people do have this impression that that Azure is just for Windows machines, but over 20% of Azure VMs actually run Linux. So the example I just showed you of Killer Video, that DataStax Enterprise cluster is absolutely running on Linux VMs in Azure. So let's talk about handling user-generated videos. So this is something that I don't normally get to talk about when I talk about Killer Video, because normally I'm just talking about Cassandra, which is fun. But I thought it would be fun to kind of talk about Azure Media Services just real quick, and just some of the stuff that's possible to do if you actually want to do video encoding or you want to do streaming video or something like that. Azure Media Services, like I said earlier, it doesn't really have an analog in one of the other cloud providers. And so AWS and GCE don't really have something like this. So if you dive in, there's a few key concepts that you kind of need to know at the beginning. And so I'm just going to kind of mention some of the key terms just so you kind of know what it's like. And then I'll show you a quick demo of it actually in action. So first thing is an asset. Asset is just a collection of digital files. So digital files being audio files, image files, video files, that kind of thing. And you can see those are actually all stored in Azure Storage. So they're actually all stored in Azure Blob Storage. Assets also have a locator. So locators are just URLs that point at Azure Storage, and they can have permissions assigned with them. So you can say, like, this URL is read-only because I only want people to be able to play back this video, and this one is for writing so that people can actually upload to this URL or something like that. You also have jobs. So job is basically just a series of tasks, and the tasks, those are like a unit of work, basically. They take an input asset of some kind, so like the source video that somebody uploads to us, and then they have an output asset that they output, so like the re-encoded video that can actually be played back on the site. And then they have a media processor, which is the thing that actually does the work of encoding the video. And then the last thing that a job has is a notification endpoint. So this is for if I want to get notifications about my encoding job as it's kind of processing, like as it's doing the re-encoding of the video, and I want to know kind of the status updates, like how is it doing, how is it going. That's basically an Azure Storage queue. So it's almost event-driven also. It's almost publishing events. It's not using Azure Service Bus like we are in the app, but something very similar in Azure Storage queue that you can subscribe to and then listen for events and maybe use that to update your UI and show the user, hey, we're making progress on that video you gave us. So one thing to talk about real quick, the sort of the last thing about Azure Media Services is when I go to upload the video, I was kind of looking at it like this is sort of the workflow I was looking at. So I have I've got my web UI, and it's going to send it's going to post some data to that MVC app, and that MVC app, it's going to stream some data back to that upload service, and then that upload service, it's going to stream data back to the Azure Storage, like to the Blob Storage, and it's like, wow, that's a lot of extra load on the app tier where I'm basically just passing bits from one tier to the next, and so you start thinking, okay, well, why don't we cut out the middleman? Like, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to have all these things in the middle of, when all we're doing is basically uploading file data. So here's what we got. We got a web UI. It's at killervideo.com, like you saw. We've got Azure Storage back there, and it's at some other URL like killervideo-storage, just as example, .windowsazure.com. And so when we try to make a request from our web UI, make an AJAX request to actually post that file data, we get cross-domain requests are not allowed. So anybody that's done any front-end development before probably knows browsers have same origin security policy. You can't make AJAX requests from one domain to another domain, right? That would be bad. You can do cross-site scripting attacks like that. So browser tries to keep you from doing that. How do we do it? So CORS, if you've never heard of CORS, CORS stands for cross-origin resource sharing. And so basically it's a way where I can tell Azure Storage, I can say, hey, it's cool if killervideo.com makes a request to you. Like, that's an allowed domain. And so I can add a CORS rule. You can do this with the Azure SDK, with the Azure Storage SDK, so you can do it programmatically. You're allowed to have up to 5 CORS rules per Azure Storage account. So you can do it that way. Or if you like nice UIs, there's a application on GitHub called CORS Azure Rule Manager or something like that. Really nice little UI that you can fire up in about 30 seconds and run that will actually let you kind of have a UI for managing those. So once I add a CORS rule, now I can make requests. Killervideo.com is an allowed domain. And so I basically cut out the middleman. I don't have all that extra load on my app tier basically to transfer bits, to stream bits from one tier to the other. So kind of cool. And if you want an example of that, like I said, the code is all open source. It's all done in JavaScript as well. So it's using HTML5 file APIs, that kind of thing. Like if you want sort of an example of how to do that or use those APIs, check the code out. Even if you're not a C# programmer, if you know JavaScript, it'll make sense. Okay, so last thing I want to talk about is Cassandra and Azure together. So the thing with Cassandra is IOPS are super important. So this is true whether you're running in the cloud, whether you're running on your own databases or your own servers, this kind of thing. Like, we typically tell people the type of disk that you choose to run your Cassandra servers on is like one of the most important decisions that you'll make as far as what kind of performance you'll get out of Cassandra. So IOPS are super important, and especially in the cloud, this can be kind of picky, like what do you choose to run on? So you kind of have two options in Azure. So you can run on A7 instances connected to Azure Blob Storage. So this is sort of the shared block storage type thing that you get with like EBS, kind of similar to EBS and AWS. So you could do that if you want. Or you can run something like G3 or G4 instances. And these are local SSD, ephemeral SSD type instances. So they've got local attached SSDs to each instance. And really the difference is kind of trading off safety and performance. So with the A7 instances that are connected to Blob Storage, you get more safety because if a virtual machine crashes and you can't bring it back up, your disks are still in Blob Storage, so you can still bring a new VM, you can spin up a new instance of that VM and connect the disks to a new VM, and all is right in the world. Whereas with the G3, G4 instances, those are ephemeral storage, so if those machines crash and burn, you're not going to be able to get back to those SSDs, right? Those SSDs are gone. Now in Cassandra, you kind of saw, like, with all the replication and everything that happens, maybe losing a node isn't such a big deal. Having to like rebuild one from scratch, maybe not as big of a deal, but it's kind of what is important to you. Like, how much do you want to trade safety versus performance? Like, what, you know, how much performance do you need versus how much safety do you want? So if you've got a small cluster and you don't need like hugely, performance isn't hugely important, you might run on these A7 instances with Blob Storage. Whereas if you're in a high performance scenario, you're getting into really big data and ingesting data really quickly, you're probably going to want to look at the ephemeral storage options. You can also do some kind of tricky things too. So like I mentioned, Cassandra does multi-DC replication. So you could actually take advantage of the fact that Cassandra does multi-data center replication, and you could run two logical data centers inside of your same physical data center, one backed by Blob Storage, one backed by ephemeral SSDs. And that way you've got sort of backup nodes for when you need the backup nodes. Or you could even do like run the really high performance ones with SSDs and do frequent backups, like frequent snapshots basically to Azure Blob Storage as well. So you kind of have like lots of choices that you can pick from. It really depends on sort of your risk tolerance. So there's two ways to set up Azure in Cassandra, Cassandra in Azure. So one is scripted VM setup from sort of the command line. So DataStax has worked with Microsoft. They put together this set of like a combination of PowerShell and Bash scripts together that you can use and kind of customize. So if you need fine control over what type of VMs and how they're configured and that kind of stuff, there's a link here to some detailed instructions, some scripts on how you can get up and running. And you'd use this to provision the VMs, and then after that, you'd run OpsCenter, and that's what you'd use to actually deploy Cassandra. Last thing I want to talk about is picking a distribution. So you probably heard me mention Apache Cassandra multiple times. You heard me mention DataStax multiple times tonight. So if you want the sort of latest bleeding edge features, you'll use Jira to file Jira tickets for support. If you need mail, you'll actually get support from the community, so mailing list. There's an IRC channel, that kind of stuff. This is perfect for hacking, perfect for trying it out. If you go to planetcassandra.org, you can get sort of the Apache version plus OpsCenter kind of packaged together. So absolutely perfect for hacking. Use this distribution if you want to. It's you can see the apache.org site as well if you want to go grab it from there. Also mentioned DataStax Enterprise. So this is a commercial version of Cassandra, like a commercial distribution of Cassandra. If you want to do, like I mentioned earlier, Cassandra itself is transactional. If you want to do some of those more like sophisticated analytics stuff on top of it, so Solr for search or Spark, which is definitely the new hotness in analytics, getting a ton of attention, that's all integrated on top of DataStax Enterprise, along with a core Cassandra component. So it's tends to lag behind the sort of bleeding edge features that you get in the open source. It's more focused on enterprise, kind of stable. Like, we'll lag behind and test it a little bit more before it gets pushed out into the wild kind of thing. And we mentioned this earlier, we have a free startup program. So if you have less than $3 million of revenue or less than $30 million of funding, you qualify. There are no restrictions. You can have DataStax Enterprise for free on as many nodes as you want. So definitely talk to us if you're interested in, we're a startup, so we'd love startups. So just a couple of parting thoughts. So spending a lot of time re-architecting your application, because you chose to use certain infrastructure or you made certain architectural decisions, you're not adding a whole lot of business value when you do that. And I realized, I worked on a legacy system for years at my last job, and I realized not all of us get to be like startups and build cool greenfield projects and stuff like that. But there are, what you need to be thinking is, are there decisions I can make now as far as infrastructure goes, as far as architecture goes, that will set me up better for when my application actually becomes the next big thing, when it actually becomes super popular? So if you're interested in learning more, check out planetcassandra.org for all things Cassandra. You can check out datastacks.com for DSE, which I mentioned, DevCenter and OpsCenter that I both showed you demos of, which are free. You can grab those on Datastacks. And Azure, azure.microsoft.com, and I'm sure the Azure guys will fill you in on any links that I missed from Microsoft. And that's it. The slides will be up on my SlideShare if you're interested. I'll take questions if anybody's got questions. So there isn't at this point, there isn't anything where you would, like a push mechanism from, push mechanism from Cassandra, not that I'm aware of. So what will actually happen in this scenario, where values conflict, is that that A equals 2 will win, but then the other thing Cassandra will do is it'll do what's called a read repair. So it'll say, hey, oh, those values conflicted. I better make sure that that node gets the latest value. And so it'll do this behind the scenes and actually go update that node so that the next time that you go to read it, that you'll actually get the latest, you won't have that conflict, that kind of thing. But there isn't any sort of push mechanism in Cassandra. I should have repeated that question. Anybody else have questions about Cassandra they want to answer? So the question was, in what cases would you use one versus Quorum? So like I mentioned in some of the earlier slides, you're going to get better speed with one. So if you just need to ingest lots of data really, really quickly, you might do writes at one. Like say, for example, log data is usually used as an example of something where if you were to miss one or something like that, it wouldn't be a big deal. But if you need to get the fastest speed that you can possibly get, you don't care about consistency as much, then you might use one. It really just depends on your the scenario in your application. And like I said, you can choose one part of your application, you could be using one. Other parts of your application, you might need stronger consistency, so you could use Quorum or whatever you need in that scenario instead. So the question was, if you're using one, why would you actually get in this scenario where you would have old data on a server? So let's say I do my write, let's say I do a write with a consistency level of one. And so when I do that write, I'm only guaranteed by the time my client code gets, by the time my client code gets an acknowledgement that says, hey, yeah, we got your write, I'm only guaranteed that one node has that piece of data. Now, like I said earlier, replication factor, it'll still get replicated, but we don't have any guarantee yet because we didn't wait on a response from the other nodes that they've got it yet. So let's say I do that write, and then immediately in my code I do a read where I try to read that value back. So I go to read that value back. And let's say that the node that I happen to talk to for that read hasn't gotten, because of physics or slow network connection between nodes or something like that, it hasn't gotten that right yet. It's over the wire, it's in transit, but it actually hasn't arrived yet. And my read request gets there first. Possible then that I might read stale data. Does that kind of make sense?
So that's why Quorum is better, right?
So the question is that why Quorum is better? That's all subjective, right? So like I said, it's tunable consistency in Cassandra. Better in some scenarios, if you're ingesting log data, better maybe I need to ingest it as fast as possible. I need to write it as fast as possible. So what is better? If you need consistency, yes, Quorum is better. Absolutely, Quorum is better for that. So you could absolutely do that. So that's almost like a time series data model. So what you're talking about is almost a time series data model. We'll talk about time series data models tomorrow where you're ingesting events and maybe they're in a particular order or something like that. And you might do a data model where you're kind of storing things next to each other in a time series order. And Cassandra is really good at ingesting stuff like that. Yep. So the question was, what happens if the main node goes down? So there's not really a main node in this scenario, right? So you have replicas, so you might have, in these examples here, Let me go back to one. Like, here's one where I had, you know, I'm reading A, and there were three servers that essentially owned that data. None of them are really the master. Like, they all equally own that data. There isn't this master-slave thing. So if one of them goes down like that, you know, like in the next slide there, one of them goes down, there's still two other nodes there available that are available for reading and writing. So there's two, basically there's two, what I was trying to say with that is that there are two things, essentially, two dials, essentially, that you can turn, one being replication factor, so how many copies there are in your cluster, and the other being what consistency level you choose to read and write at. That's the other thing that controls how available your data will be. Well, so if nodes go down, yes, absolutely, Cassandra still works. So like if you lose a node, or you can, like I said before, if you're in a multi-data center setup, you can lose an entire data center and you can fail your traffic over to that other data center. And because it's fully replicated, you'll have full copies of your data in both data centers. No, there is no configuration server, no.
Yeah,
no. It's all, all nodes are equal, shared nothing, peer-to-peer type architecture. Yeah, there is no single point of failure, basically.
Yep. Okay,
you can't lose one node and all of a sudden it's catastrophe. Yeah. Okay. That would be bad. That wouldn't be any better than sharding and replication and all the other stuff I showed you. So
sounds good.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Woo!